I never had any doubt that this was going to be a safe procedure and that it would work because our data was so good. And it was, I think it was only fitting that the people who were working on it had their children immunized before we went out to the general public. The myth has arisen. I mean, when you read all the accounts, it was Jonas Salk who did his own children and never mentioned that anybody else in the lab's children were done. So part of the myth building that's gone on over the years.
Okay. And Mrs. Younger, she had no doubts?
None at all.
You also mentioned last time that a group of Jewish philanthropists bought the municipal hospital specifically to make a Salk Institute.
That's right. I mean, I have no firsthand knowledge of this. This is what I understood from Jonas Salk, that the municipal it was municipal hospital. It was a city hospital where the lab was located.
Mm-hmm.
The building was essentially underused, as I told you the last time, because once antibiotics came in the early 40s, sulfonamides, antibiotics, infectious disease hospitals became an anachronism, became no longer necessary. And this hospital, I think, opened in like 1940, just at the wrong time. It never was fully occupied by infectious diseases. It did have a third floor that was filled with a polio ward, was filled with people, kids and adults with polio. The public health school had moved in there before they had their own building, and so they were housed in that building too, but they were soon to move out, or they had already moved out when the Perrin Hall was built with Mellon money. The Mellon gave the money to build the public health school on DeSoto Street. And so the hospital was mostly empty, and it was a keep Jonas in town and to let him expand his activities, it was decided that this would be a good place for him to expand his activities and build an institute. And the money was raised to buy the building from the city, and I understand that the Jewish community, some of the wealthier members of the Jewish community put up the money to buy the building. And very soon after it was bought, he announced he's going to California.
Since we already have that, you know any of the names of the Jewish.
No.
And you, have you any idea what the feeling was?
It was very
when
great.
They got,
there was a great disappointment.
I would think so.
Yeah, great disappointment. And.
But they did give it to the medical school.
They gave it
anyway,
to the university.
Okay. And the third question, again, has to do with Salk family. The brother who was the veterinarian,
mm-hmm.
had a farm in the North Hills, you mentioned.
It wasn't his farm. The farm was owned by a wealthy Jewish businessman, Brauerman or something like that. I can't remember the name, but he owned this farm out in Wexford, or Mars. It was up north out of 19 somewhere. And Herman Salk ran this farm for him, moved his family there. He was a great friend of Jonas's.
The Jewish man. Yes.
His brother moved onto the farm and managed it and raised animals and started selling biologicals to the lab and to others. And that went on for quite a number of years till he moved to, as I told you, to Palm Springs and became a psychiatrist, pet psychiatrist.
Okay, thank you. Now, when you came to Pittsburgh as a Jew in 49 to the university, were there any feelings of anti-Semitism at the university? How were you treated?
I never felt it myself. I never felt any kind of anti-Semitism at the university, although if I looked around at the medical faculty, there were very, very few Jewish professors. Very few. And don't forget that in 1949, this was what's called a proprietary medical school. Most of the medical faculty were practicing physicians in town who weren't full-time in the medical school. The preclinical departments were very small and had minimal faculty, and they're housed in terrible conditions, and there was very little research going on. in the medical school at that time. So there was, it was apparent there were very few Jewish faculty members in the faculty. The other thing that I heard soon after coming was that there was a quota for Jewish medical students. And there were very few Jewish medical students, but there were always some in each class. And I heard that Jonas Salk and others told me that there was a committee of Jewish philanthropists and physicians in town who were called the Committee of the 13, who actually decided which meritorious Jewish students, applicants, would fill the slots in the Pitt Medical School. In other words, the medical school admissions procedure gave them the authority to pick the Jews who would go to medical school.
And this is by merit or by family connection?
I had nothing to do with the process. Yeah. There were some excellent, excellent physicians who are practicing in our community today who were trained during that period, so that there was nothing wrong with these people. They were really, they had to be, I think, the best of the best to get in, to make that cut. But it was horrifying to me to see that the Jewish community was cooperating in this kind of quota procedure. And I found it rather obnoxious. This changed with time. Because after the polio vaccine, there was a real surge of interest in building the medical school then. And there was a money came from the Mellons, actually the Mellon interest, the Scaife family. And they gave the money to build the Scaife Hall, and the then dean of the medical school appointed a group of physicians who were more interested in research and advancing the status of the medical school, and that was the first renaissance. It was part of the renaissance in Pittsburgh. And so there was an attempt to upgrade the medical school so it was competitive with other medical schools in the United States, and also to take advantage of the new surge of medical funding for medical research. And so this was the first renaissance of the medical school, and that saw the opening of Scaife Hall, the hiring of large numbers of basic scientists, research scientists, preclinical teachers, PhDs, hiring full-time clinical faculty, making the hospital, making closer relationships with the hospital and the medical school on a formal basis, and actually putting, raising the number of students in the medical school. And at that time, the barriers started to dissolve to Jews and to both in the faculty and the student body.
Was Montefiore affiliated in any way at that time?
Montefiore was affiliated the way Presbyterian Hospital was affiliated. Later on, as you may know, there was Presby became very closely affiliated with the medical school, and Montefiore wanted to keep its distance, and there was a period of a terrible combat between the Presbyterian medical and surgical Norwich staff and Montefiore, the boards, which was not really settled until Tom Detry took over as vice chancellor. And that was the second renaissance of the medical school, is when he came in as first interim dean and then as vice chancellor for health sciences. And what you see now in the medical school as the second renaissance is really in large measure attributed to his imagination, drive, and ability to get things done. A lot of people have found his personality and his methods unpopular, but he is a man who really knows how to get things done and also has a high regard for quality. He tends to be ruthless and appears to be, as he says, he's not in any popularity contest. He's not here to be loved, as he puts it. So this is the second, and it was very exciting to me to be part of this.
So you were actually part of both Renaissance?
Yes.
Renaissance.
Yes. I wasn't an organizer or a player in the first Renaissance. The second one, at the beginning, I was one of those who opposed some of the things that the Deputy wanted to do, and lost all the battles that I had. But then found that he, in many cases, was right, and admitted that I was acting in self-interest or for the wrong reasons, and we've become good allies since then.
Can you tell us a little bit about your early years in Pittsburgh, other than professional, your family life?
I took to Pittsburgh right away. I liked it immediately. My family prospered here. We found it very congenial living in Pittsburgh. And we made many good friends. And at that time, you make friends at that time in your life. You make friends through your children, school mates and school activities and so forth. So, and through the university. So, we never had real, since we weren't members of any congregation and weren't in the group that joins social clubs or eligible for any of the private things. Our friends tended to be university people most of the time. And you were asking me where we lived. Mm-hmm. Well, we lived in 5227 Fifth Avenue on the top floor of an apartment house in a small apartment. When we first came, we only had one child. And then when the second child was coming, we moved to 6815 Penn Avenue, which is in Point Breeze, on the trolley tracks, and had a larger apartment there. And it was terribly noisy. There was a trolley car that still operated on Penn Avenue, and it was horrible in the summertime. Awful. And then in 1954, we bought this house and moved here. So we've been in this house now since 1954, almost 40 years.
Do you want to talk about your wife, your first wife?
My first wife was a freshman. When I was a graduate student, she was a freshman at Michigan. There on scholarship, she was a native Detroiter. And we met. At lunch one day, I made the acquaintance and had a friendship with somebody who was there getting a PhD named Manny Bilski, who had been a high school teacher in Detroit and who had come to Michigan to get a PhD in philosophy.
Wow.
And had been an English teacher. And I was having lunch with him one day, and this girl came over to the table, and he introduced me. She had been a student of his in Detroit in high school, and she was at Michigan on a scholarship. She came from a working class family, and I don't know how else to put it, but it was love at first sight. I mean, that was it.
You mentioned that was it. First take. How did she react to Pittsburgh as you did?
She liked Pittsburgh very much.
And she was part of the community.
Yeah, and actually, it was very good for her here too, because after our second child, I think she went back. It was after the second child. I can't remember where exactly she did, but she had never finished her degree in Michigan, so she came here and she went to Pitt and got her undergraduate degree, and then went on and got a master's degree in classics, and was going to have a career until she became a...
And what year did she die?
She died in 1963. Mm-hmm. It was very interesting, her death, because she died in Greece.
Oh, really?
No, because I had made some connections with scientists in Greece on a trip there, and they had sent somebody here to work with me for a couple of years in a medical school in Athens. And part of the plan was for me to go back go to Athens as a visiting professor and help them set up a virus lab there. And so I took a sabbatical leave in 1963 and went to Greece. And we went, although my wife was very ill. She had done very well for many years, but in those days she had Hodgkin's disease. But in those days they didn't know what they know now about Hodgkin's disease. And so she had a process that was very radio sensitive, so that treatment worked very well. But today, with the staging of Hodgkin's disease, she probably would have been cured, because she had the kind of onset that Mario Lemieux had, exactly the same pattern. But with him, they know what to do. They're radiating his whole chest and excising the node and so forth. With her, they didn't do that. They just did local radiation.
Is she that young on the onset?
She's quite young.
Really? Mm-hmm. So how long was she living before?
Well, she was diagnosed sometime in the 40s.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so she lived for 20 years. And, you know, would have long periods of remission. But anyway, the question was whether to forget about my sabbatical and not go to Greece. And she insisted we go, because she said if she's going to die, she's going to die. She wants to die there, not here. And she did.
Were the children with you?
Just my daughter. My son was in college at the time. So that was kind of a strange ending to the sabbatical. What else can I tell you? Pittsburgh. So she gave her opportunity. She was very active in the League for Women Voters. League of Women Voters. I was very interested in that.
Now this is in the 50s and 60s, I'm trying to remember.
Well, the 50s. By the 60s, she was no longer doing active work.
So it was before the Vietnam War?
Before, yes. Before, yeah, well before the Vietnam War.
Do you have any comments, personal comments, about the 60s?
The 60s, they were terrible. I wouldn't want to go back to the 60s again. The civil rights, well, I was only, there's only one active thing I did in the civil rights that I'd like to tell you about. This is very, very illustrative of some things. Sometime in the 50s, late 50s, middle 50s, do you remember there was a case in Mississippi, the Emmett Till case? The physician who was head of the NAACP, there was a physician, I wish I could remember his name, came to Pittsburgh to gather support for the Mississippi movement after the Emmett Till.
Do you want to elaborate on that for the chat?
Emmett Till? Yeah. Emmett Till was a young boy, an adolescent from Chicago, who went to visit his family in Mississippi and supposedly whistled at a white woman and was murdered for that offense. And it became a national cause célèbre because of the crudity of the whole thing. This was, of course, before the big civil rights movement. This was I would guess, the middle 50s that this happened. This man came to Pittsburgh, this man who was protesting this and who was head of some civil rights movement, maybe the NAACP, and he was a physician. And he came here and...
Was he black or white?
Black physician. And he contacted a man named Leslie Falk, who was a physician, who was head of the mine workers' health and welfare hospital clinic in, I can't remember where it was in Pennsylvania, somewhere in this. Outside of Pennsylvania.
I think it was in West Virginia.
Oh, well, but it was someplace, I wish I could remember it. It was the Health and Welfare Fund had a clinic, and he was head of this clinic and health and welfare medical side. And also very liberal, very pro-labor, very very liberal man.
And he's part of the Falk family?
No, I have no relation to the Falk family yet.
Okay.
Spelled
the same way?
Exactly the same way, but no relation at all to the local Falks. He was a New Yorker. So this physician from Maryland, from Mississippi, came to Pittsburgh, and a meeting was set up to listen to hear his story and for him to get support. And the meeting was organized by Leslie Falk and a young Unitarian minister who preceded a man named Irving, who was head of the Unitarian Church in Shady Stone. And the two of them called a group of professional people together to listen to this man present his story. And Jonas Salk was one. Jonas Salk was one of those, but Jonas Salk was the one who introduced me to Leslie Falk. And sort of an organization was set up for civil rights, informally, headed by the minister from the Unitarian Church in Oakland, I guess, on Ellsworth Avenue. I don't know where that's Oakland or Shady, where you would call that, Shady Sun.
That was me.
Oh, I wish I could remember his name. I'm very bad on names. But he was the one who preceded a minister who, of that church, was here for a long time, whose name was Irving, but he was the one who preceded Irving. And they had gave money, and they had a newsletter, and they were starting a campaign to raise money for civil rights movement in Mississippi and keep people informed what was going on. It was the newsletter that was sent out. And that went on for quite a while. Two interesting things that I can tell you about that, which are very illustrative. One is that from a minister's point of view, he lost his pastorate there, and I understood it was because he was too liberal. I mean, he was taking part in these. And just don't forget, this was during the McCarthy era, so everybody had to be very careful. And I know, I don't have personal knowledge, first-hand knowledge of this, but my understanding is that he was asked to leave because his activities were too left-wing for the community. The other interesting thing I have to tell you about this is that one day I went to Jonas and I said, boy, did you read that interesting thing in the newsletter, some item in that newsletter that we got every month or whatever it was. He said, I don't get it anymore. And I said, why not? How come? And he said, well, I resigned from the organization. I asked him to take my name off the mailing list. I said, how come? He said, well, he doesn't think it would look good for him to be associated with a group like that because of his reputation would suffer.
Was this before the serum was released?
Yeah.
But he already had a reputation.
It's an illustration of his attitude towards himself. Anyway, those are two interesting things about the civil rights movement, early civil rights movement in Pittsburgh. I was a member for many years of the NAACP. I was. And I didn't renew my membership at a time when the organization became unfriendly. It became very nationalistic for blacks and unfriendly to whites and especially to Jews. And I felt this very strongly and didn't feel comfortable anymore in the organization, so I didn't renew my membership.
About what year was that?
This was sometime in the 60s, late 60s.
Did
early
70s,
maybe.
Did have any impact in medical school? Was there any impact with McCarthy?
There was, because you remember that the state of Pennsylvania insisted on a loyalty oath for all teachers in the state of Pennsylvania. And since the University of Pittsburgh was part of the state, schools by that time getting money from the state, always got money from the state, not what it gets now, but the medical school got capitation from the state, even in those days, before the university was state-related, the medical school always got all the medical schools got capitation from the state.
Mm-hmm.
So the medical school especially, I think the whole university, but the medical especially, I'm not aware what went on the rest of the university, they were supposed to be, everybody was supposed to sign a loyalty oath.
Did you?
No.
Tell us that.
The medical school faculty was very resentful about this questioning of their loyalty, and there was a lot of talk about people not, you know, not signing the loyalty oath and not wanting to do it. And the impasse was solved by the then dean of the medical school, a man named Francis Sargent Cheever. Who was Francis Sargent, like a sergeant. And
okay.
Cheever, like the novelist. And he was a Boston Brahmin from the Boston Cheevers, who was here in Pittsburgh.
Oh, really?
And the sergeants. And he was dean at the time. And he solved the problem by, in his Boston way, writing a letter to the chancellor or the governor, I don't know who got was supposed to get this loyalty oath sent to, saying that he personally vouches for the loyalty of all the faculty in the School of Medicine, and that was it. That was the end of it.
That's fantastic.
He was really great, okay. And that took care of, that defused the whole situation. And
what happened
never,
in the undergraduate school?
I have no idea. I think there was a lot of opposition to doing it. I'm not aware of what happened there. But that's what happened in the medical school. He was a very admirable man. And that's about my connection. The Vietnam War, I really never was a demonstrator. My son was a demonstrator. My son was really very much opposed to the war. He was in medical school at the time. And I was glad that he was never had to go serve doing service.
How about your daughter? You mentioned that she was a bit of a rebel.
My daughter was a rebel. My daughter was a casualty of the 60s in some ways because she was an excellent student. She's a very bright woman. But she was caught up in the 60s, the rebellious 60s, and so when she ran into opposition at Taylor Alderbass High School, she just quit. I mean, it was the drop out.
You mentioned that.
Yeah, so the schools, also I really found that the schools were not very understanding or adaptable to children like that. The issues were, the lines were drawn so sharply and so firmly that there was no give. An example is that she was in the scholars program at Alderdice. It was very early days of the scholars program, and she was one of the first in the scholars program, and she wanted to take she didn't want to take math, she wanted to take another language. I can't remember what the issue was, but there was a scholars program.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't want to take one of the classes in the scholars program to substitute something that she was really interested in. And the rule was, either you take all the scholars program or you get out of the scholars program. And that did it.
I think they've adapted a little bit.
Oh, I think they're much more flexible now. I think they're much more flexible now. But then they were completely and totally inflexible, and nothing that the parents could do or the children could do would change the rules. I mean, these were the rules. It was a time when people like my daughter, who is a really free spirit of her and has really strong feelings about things. She just said, that's it. They don't want me, I don't want them. And quit. And she's one of those people who really did very well without school. I mean, she's really done.
We have her story on, I think, the very first case.
Yeah.
How did you feel with the establishment of Israel?
Oh, this was, I remember the day that this happened. I remember where I was and what I was doing the day.
1948, right?
47? 8. When the UN vote 48, was it? Okay, that was 48. And I remember I was with another, my wife and I and another couple were having dinner on Connecticut Avenue in Washington, D.C. in a Mexican restaurant. And the news came that the UN boat had established Israel.
Oh,